This week on Decentralize, the young people advancing the future of decentralization. Then we talk to Syed Kareem of Outer Net.
I'm Tony Sakic.
I'm Jazz Ferguson.
I'm James Walpole.
And I'm Eric Martindale.
And this is Decentralize.
Hello, Decentralized listeners. Welcome to episode 34. We're really glad to have you. This week's episode is going to be a bit shorter than usual. Our co-hosts are kind of scattered around the country doing their various work to decentralize things or taking some well-deserved and well-needed rest and relaxation time. As for me, I've actually just come back from San Francisco, my first time over there in the land of milk and honey for people interested in tech, or at least so I've been told. I was very frustrated. You know, when you go to Hawaii, you expect people there to give you leis, obviously, when you get off the plane. I was really upset that when I landed in San Francisco, I was not greeted by venture capitalists offering me complimentary venture funding. Very disappointing, but in many ways, San Francisco definitely lives up to the better stereotypes. It's definitely a really cool city. And I want to share a little bit about sort of what I did there that I thought you might find interesting. I was attending the Thiel Summit. I'm sponsored by the Thiel Foundation, which is Peter Thiel's sort of endowment for not just sort of broader nonprofit projects, but also for actually young people who are building interesting things. I guess I could count myself among that number. I definitely found myself out of my league at this seminar, which is really cool. I was glad to do it. And one of the best things to do is actually be around people smarter than you. So at this Thiel Summit, which is actually the largest one ever, there were about maybe 300 students actually 300 kind of entrepreneurs and inventors and thinkers from around the world, large contingent from Moldova and Ukraine actually, but large number of people from the United States as well. I was there with Praxis. We had our graduating class was kind of celebrating and attending to talk about education and sort of education alternatives and startup apprenticeship at this event. But we were also interacting with a lot of other young people. And the reason I wanted to share this is because I found it really inspiring to be among so many young people working on projects, while not directly related to decentralization, but which had the practical effect of potentially being very decentralized technologies. I talked to a gentleman from a company called Ubiquity. That's Ubiquity. That's Ubiquity without the TY. Working on a technology to allow syncing and peer-to-peer communication between devices without cloud storage, which I thought was pretty awesome. Definitely excited my interest as somewhat interested in security. Met a young man named Praveen Loganathan, the CEO and co-founder of Infusion Technologies. He started this company when he was 16. I believe he started this company 2 years ago when he was 17, and has been running it while he's been in college, which is quite fascinating. Met a young man named Jonathan Shobrook, who has been running his design business from his high school classroom. Just remarkable people, and it's really inspiring to see that, and definitely heartening. I mean, maybe I'm biased as a young person myself, but maybe it's sappy to say, but I mean, you know, young people are quote unquote the future, and seeing so many really cool projects validated that. All these people are really interested in innovating without permission, and freedom without permission, and the way they're aiming to do that is through creating things, and that's really inspiring. It's something, you know, that has been very important for me as an ethos to adopt. It's not something I've always had. I've always been interested in ideas, but to actually be among this community of makers has been really life-changing. I think it's something that everyone can benefit from, but I did want to share a little bit sort of about that to kind of give you an idea of sort of what's going on, even with sort of big funding and big names like Peter Thiel. He's really he's doing his bit for sure to ensure that kind of these ideas have a have an umbrella and have a area of support to move forward with. And certainly not just to praise Peter Thiel. I mean, certainly it's one small part of this, but all of the young people who are making their own way, whether that means, you know, not following traditional education or starting things like venture funds to support anti-aging technologies, like one of the speakers did. She's 21 years old. It's just remarkable. And I mean, I think a lot of the fact that young people can actually find these resources to become entrepreneurs and find the education that makes it possible is attributable to the decentralized and distributed nature of a lot of the technologies we've grown up with, or my generation's grown up with. And it's definitely inspiring of a lot of hope. Obviously, we kind of talked last week about Ross Ulbricht's conviction and sentencing, and it's very dark news, and there's a lot of dark news out there, but there's a lot of inspiring stuff too. I think the Geo Summit was one of them. Being in San Francisco for me was one of them as well. I don't know, maybe it's the spirit of the West or the frontier or something like that. But it's definitely, I think we're in a good position to move forward with what we care about, and know that, you know, the future is not in the hands of the politicians. It's not in the hands of the necessarily the large, you know, more established incumbents out there in technology or whatever. It's oftentimes going to be very radically altered by young people like this. And you maybe one or two or three out of this whole group of 300 may go on to do something really, really fantastic and magnificent. But maybe it's just a general ethos of people sort of taking charge of their own lives and knowing that they can do something different now, that doing something different, it has become far more possible and also far more praiseworthy than it's ever been. So that's something I'm very excited about, is this cultural shift we're seeing. And I find that really encouraging. And I hope you do too. But this episode is not all about young people doing interesting projects. As much as I'd like to dwell on that as a young person myself, we're also talking about everyone working in the area of decentralization. And one gentleman, but older than me, but who's been working on a very significant project in the area of communication and information freedom is Syed Karim of OuterNet. And we're looking forward to interviewing him in the next segment. So without further ado, decentralized listeners, I will let you get to that interview. And we'll see you next week. Hopefully we'll have the whole team back together, and we'll be talking about some really cool projects out there.
Today we're live with Syed Karim, who is the founder and CEO of OuterNet, which is a project planning to bring the information of internet to everybody. Syed, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So why don't you go ahead and get us started? What is exactly the concept of OuterNet?
So the whole notion of OuterNet is to bring valuable information that now is oftentimes primarily found on the internet and make it accessible to places that don't have, for whatever reason, access to the internet. So essentially what we're doing, video or TV or radio, and applying it to a data service. Everything now, as far as content, can be digitized and turned into packets. And so what we do is just make offline versions of content and then go ahead and broadcast it, as of right now, over 6-7 different satellites. And we hope to go ahead and increase that both from a content delivery perspective and also from different frequencies all over the world.
Very cool. I was just telling you off air that I thought OuterNet was one of the coolest projects we've highlighted on here, and that's no offense to our other cool projects. And I think it's something that has been around for a bit, but tell us where it's already, how it's already being used, and how do you want it to be used, in the near future, as well as what reactions and use cases have you expected or do you really hope to come true with it, and that you maybe pitch to investors or prospective investors?
Sure. So let's see. There's a lot in there. So remind me if I miss anything. So as far as how we would like for it to be used, so naturally we'd like to. We consider this as almost like a mashup, right? So it's a mashup of BitTorrent and Reddit, a little bit of YouTube thrown in there. And so the reason I use those as examples is, BitTorrent essentially as kind of a downloading of content service and, kind of emphasize the whole notion that it is a unidirectional system as of right now. The whole reason that we exist is to solve the information access problem. And so one way to do that is by creating space-based internet that's accessible everywhere. But the problem with that is fundamentally a cost issue. And the other thing that we're doing is I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. It's going to be used. And so because we want to keep this as decentralized as possible and essentially not have this a gatekeeper service like let's say, like normal traditional media. What we're doing is planning on opening up essentially a self-service application that allows anyone to be able to say, hey, I think this is important that the world should be able to aware of it, and kind of upload relevant and important information and then broadcast it over our network. So essentially what we do is we operate where anyone to be able to contribute to it. So that will actually be available in about a month. Up until for the past about year that we've been operating, we've really been focusing on getting all of our back-end and front-end systems, you know, delivering hardware, making sure firmware works, all that stuff. And in about a month or so is when we're going to be really releasing, saying, hey, this is how anyone can interact. This is what you need to be able to build your own receiver. This is what you need if you want to interface with. And working towards for the past, you know, essentially over the past year. As far as, you know, what has been kind of the pitch that we've been making, you know, both to customers, to investors, you know, that there's really no reason that this should not exist. And so, there, you know, the whole notion of there being a basic level of information accessible to everyone, to a large degree, we have a similar platform that exists, you know, in TV, radio, and also in GPS. You know, we already have similar types of broadcast data service. And so essentially what we're saying is that, you know, there's more information that should be accessible to everyone, and this is one way to do it.
So Syed, what is sort of the philosophy behind this project for you? Why did you consider it so important to get this information out to everyone?
Why? You know, so there's two sides to that. You know, one could be completely cynical, and one could be really more much more idealistic. And, you know, what really drives me is the nature of the problem to be solved. And solving a problem that affects far more people than it doesn't. So, you know, we say we tend to, you know, based on where we all come from, I'm fairly certain that everyone's, you know, grew up in the States, and, you know, naturally our network infrastructure is maybe not the best in the world, but still, you know, much better than it is in a lot of places, actually much better than it is in the vast majority of the world. And so if we're saying idealistically, it's like, hey, this is a pain point, this is a problem to be solved for billions of people, that's really where it came to do, is basically information access. If we're talking about, you know, the global economy, the modern economy, it's, you know, fundamentally related to access to information, access to education, skills being developed as a result of all that. What really separates, the only thing that separates people nowadays is really being able to acquire skills or, you know, gain opportunity as a result of access. A very inexpensive, relatively inexpensive and fast way to be able to solve that the divide when it comes to information access. And note that I'm not using the word internet access. Naturally, that is something that we want to move towards at some point, but instead of waiting 5 or 10 years for proprietary rocket ships or you know, satellite factories to be developed, this is something we can do, you know, almost instantaneously, as we've shown over the past few months. And then the other side of it is like, hey, you know, what we get over and over again is what we hear is like, you know, is this a nonprofit, is it a charity? It's like, no, it's not at all. I mean, ultimately, we're operating a broadcast service, and so no one really kind of questions, oh, is CNN a charity? You know, they offer free information, or, you know, is, you know, the your local radio stations, are they charities? They operate, you know, free information and entertainment services. So ultimately, more often than not, and very lately, I've been getting annoyed by that, because to me, it just seems like a stupid question, because there are alternatives that solve similar problems or at least approach it the same way. And, you know, and essentially what we're saying is that we can solve a problem at scale and still, you know, do good and do well at the same time. So, you know, that's kind of the both sides of it, is what really drives, you know, myself and my team is naturally to be able to provide an information service to everyone to be able to solve those problems. But ultimately, there has to be some kind of a way to scale this from a financial perspective. And you know, there's a perfectly justifiable way to do so.
So, Syed, you talk a lot about increasing the availability of information, and it seems like that is probably one of your core values here. Is there another secondary factor that you're considering? Is it privacy? I mean, is there something else here that's driving what you guys are doing?
Sure. So, you know, privacy is definitely one. There's in especially when we're talking about the reasons why information doesn't exist in certain places. That is generally related to three three factors. So one is infrastructure, just that it doesn't exist. That's actually kind of a half reason. Internet access actually exists everywhere in the world. The only thing that prevents anyone from gaining access to the internet is really cost, and it's really a financial barrier. So even in places where you can be in the middle of the Sahara and say, "Oh well, you know, infrastructure doesn't exist," actually, you know, space-based assets do exist and do work in everywhere, except for in some cases the poles. Actually, even Iridium works there. So it's really not a matter of whether it exists or not. It's just a matter of, do you have the money to be able to pay for it? And so then we're really going down to, well, you know, what are the two reasons that certain types of information aren't accessible? And so one is really a financial or economic barrier. And the other one is, it really has to do with more of a political barrier when it comes to access to information. So in some places, in actually huge swaths of the world, there's just different filters or means to be able to prevent access to certain types of information, either changing it or just blocking it completely. And one of the things, the way to solve for that is to create a broadcast system where people can opt into receiving without having to leave a trail or some kind of breadcrumbs behind as far as what their activities when it comes to the consumption of information are. So what we're guaranteeing from one of the benefits to the broadcast system is that it guarantees the anonymity of consumption. When you're, you know, reading up a newspaper, no one actually knows what it is that you're doing, and you know, by and large, you know, it doesn't matter. It's not like it's an experience that you have to hold, you know, very private. But it's also one of those things. Well, why should anyone have the right to know? And so that's one of the things that we do get to guarantee from the way that this system's been designed.
And speaking of the design of the system, how has it evolved over time? What was the shell of the idea that this started, and what was the structure and level of centralization, and how did it change? Again, I have a tendency to ask too many questions in one, so I guess we'll just stick with the main one of, you know, how has it evolved? How has it changed?
Sure. So, I mean, the one thing that hasn't changed is, you know, over the past year or so, you know, we announced what we were doing, you know, a little over a year ago, and really got into sketching out exactly our plan of attack almost a year precisely. And the problem and the general solution has not changed. The problem we've identified is access to information. So what is the fastest way to be able to create, you know, the equivalent of humanity's public library, to be able to create a digital version of the Library of Alexandria that's accessible to everyone? So one of the first things we did was saying, hey, what we're really not trying to do is create the internet for everyone. That's a problem left to Google. That's a problem left to Facebook or Elon Musk or whoever it is. Let them solve it in the next 5 to 10 years. You know, as a little side note is that Bill Gates wanted to solve that too, you know, about 10 years ago, and he said he didn't have enough money to solve it, or at least didn't want to spend the money to do so. So we wanted to be able to tackle a problem that we thought was important, and also that we could do, something that we could solve pretty quickly. And so that's one way is that the problem has been focused on access to information, not access to the internet. And then as far as the things that have changed, so naturally, you start getting into execution, then it's a matter of, okay, well, should we use small satellites? Should we use large satellites? Should we use this kind of protocol versus the other standard? Should we use, you know, a Raspberry Pi or a Beagle in Black? You know, and then you start getting into kind of the minutiae of what it takes to actually get something, a plan rolling, and to solve problems in the field. And so that has changed a little bit here and there, but more or less it stayed on the same trajectory. What has changed is saying that, okay, well, maybe this isn't one decision from previous decision is not the most cost-effective, or it's not the most expeditious manner for us to be able to roll out. So those are the things, you know, whether it's, you know, it's geostationary or LEO or things of those nature, you know, really quite technical decisions. But that's what has maybe modified a bit in the past year.
Sahid, you talked a little bit about scalability and about sort of bringing this project to everyone, and obviously it takes some cash. I know Outernet has a plan to broadcast for free, but is there sort of a monetization model that's going to support your continued expansion?
Absolutely. So even though we aren't long-term, at least, wholly focused on hardware, you know, we have a different kind of a rollout strategy, but we are, you know, building our own hardware now, and naturally, when you build something and you sell it, you know, a physical device, then, you know, you get to benefit from margin. So that's something, and the benefit to having a hardware business is that from a cash flow perspective, it works pretty well. You sell something, you get a piece of it, and then, you know, you sell some more stuff and market it more, and it's a nice, you know, happy cycle. The other way, as you sell more devices, that means your audience increases in size. And as an audience increases in size, some people want to be able to reach that audience. And so we don't have an advertising model. What we have is a sponsorship model. So whether regardless of what it is that your content is, whether if it happens to be messaging about a product or it happens to be your podcast, or maybe you want to be able to sponsor and information that you think is important, let's say like Wikipedia or weather or OpenStreetMaps, that's something that you can do over our system. So that's a model right now that has to do with paid content, essentially content sponsorship. And then, of course, we're opening up the platform, and so we're not entirely sure what's going to happen. Essentially, saying that here, this is how you build hardware. This is the software that you need. It's freeware. Most of it is open source, and this is how you bounce stuff off the satellites. And we'll let developers figure out ways to be able to build applications that work in the kind of offline environment that we have. So the third component is kind of a wild card, and we'll just kind of let the market take over there.
So you mentioned a few minutes ago this idea of a digital library of Alexandria, right, where all this content is available for people to consume. How do you guys go through that selection process? How do you determine what is actually going to be in your library?
So number one is that we personally, Outernet doesn't want to be the ones to determine that. We would like to have such a flow of information that it's really up to the user to determine what it is that they want. And it's almost like kind of filtering based on interest. And so whether that interest is language, whether it's geography, whether it's topic area, category, that's something that you kind of filter on the receiver itself. So your receiver, the analogy on a radio is not that far off. Let's call it like a mashup of a regular FM receiver and Amazon.com. And what I mean by that is, so you're tuned into the frequency, like an FM radio, and then once you have that, you're just getting a whole bunch of information. So like you've gone to Amazon, you've said, I want to buy a chair. And then it's a matter of, okay, well, you have 17 million results. What kind of a chair? You want a wooden chair? You want a rocking chair? You want a chair that has that is Amazon Prime? You want something that's handcrafted, or maybe at a certain dollar point. So you get to do that faceted search based on that criteria, and that's really what the user experience is heading towards. So we just go ahead and give it a fire hose of information and let the user determine what it is that they want to keep or throw out. So naturally, when it comes to the uplinking or the uploading of information, there's a small segment of the capacity that staff will basically create a daily newsletter around, but the vast majority of it we would really like the world at large to determine as what is important and useful.
So Syed, you also mentioned that basically the software for receiving broadcasts from Outernet is open source. Are there any projects or developers out there building anything of note to you as far as applications of the software?
No, so I also want to be very clear and transparent about the open source. So the majority of it is open source, and you can go ahead and check it out, GitHub's Outernet. Is it Outernet-project on GitHub is what you would search for. And then there is a small piece of it, which is our data casting client. That is free, but that part is not open source. So that aside, it still allows you to build hardware and also to build applications. Being that we've been kind of huddled around making sure everything works the way that they need to, and also creating some documentation for people to build their own applications, there hasn't been a lot of I'm almost certain that there's been no contributions, maybe a few, maybe four or five pull requests, fixing bugs and the such for our Raspberry Pi image. But we expect that to change once we announce exactly the fact that we are globally accessible. We're available on these different satellites, and we point to our repos to be able to say, hey, fork it, change it, figure out some way to take advantage of it.
Cool. And I know you went into a little bit about the hardware earlier, and that was one of the parts that interested me the most. Now, let's say that I'm wanting to run to the store right now and buy the equipment to build this hardware. What would one need? And is this something that you're planning to create as a commercial product in the future?
Oh, absolutely. So we're releasing a commercial product very soon. It's a DVB-S receiver that has a integrated Wi-Fi radio, which we turn into an access point. So by and large, what this receiver is a fairly low-cost system on a chip, as well as some internal storage, some USB storage, memory and all that, and then a DVB-S tuner and a Wi-Fi radio. So you smack that all together, and you can describe it in many ways. I like to describe it as essentially a Wi-Fi access point that has a integrated satellite tuner. You can just describe it the inverse of that as well. So basically what it does is you hook up a external dish to it, tune into the right frequency, and then download all the content that's being delivered over the course of that day or for however long you have it. That's something we have two models right now to be able to either build it yourself or actually just buy it. So in about a month or so, you'll be able to just buy something that works out of the box. It has the software that's flashed, and then it's just a matter of pointing your dish and hooking it up, and then, you know, presto, it's downloading. The other way to be able to do it is as long as you have a Linux-compatible DVB-S tuner, and so this is essentially the little piece of component that if you've ever seen a satellite dish, what's kind of funny is that in the U.S. there's a completely different standard that is dominant versus the rest of the world. Basically, everywhere it uses in the U.S. is DV, direct broadcast satellite service, you know, DirecTV and Dish TV. Everywhere else is DVB-S, and so it's slightly different in that different components are involved. But ultimately, you have an LNB which receives the signal at, you know, Ku-band. Ku-band is, you know, what is it, roughly like 10 gigahertz, 12 gigahertz. Then there's a little nub on that dish. It's called an LNB. That's something that down converts that signal into L-band, and L-band is roughly between 950 megahertz and 2150 megahertz. And that is what's fed to the receiver, that L-band. The L-band, there's a RF, there's a F connector. And so as the signal travels to the F connector, it goes to a demodulator. And these are generally pretty inexpensive demodulator chips because of the fact that everyone in the world uses this standard, the DVB-S standard. And so from there, the signal is turned from that transport stream, originally said transport stream, comes back down over the satellite, and it's demodulated into data. Once it's in data, then it gets passed on to the SOR software, the data casting client, turns it into usable files. And then once the usable files are just kind of stuffed into the onboard storage, you know, 64 gig flash drive, that's when you can start interacting with it. No differently from if you were at the airport and you see that captive portal. So at that point, when you turn on the receiver, whether it's a Raspberry Pi or whether it's our own device called a Pillar, you see a Wi-Fi. If you're in the vicinity, you'll see a Wi-Fi access point called OuterNet. It's an open network. You associate with that network, and you'll see you'll immediately be led to a particular website that'll say librarian.outernet. From there, you'll see all the content that's been downloaded. Sometimes there may be offline applications, there'll be some Comcademy videos. Essentially, at that point, it just goes into the content experience, which, like I said, we want to be a little bit more hands-off again, since we want to let, you know, the world kind of determine that. But that's exactly how the hardware operates, whether it's, you know, build it yourself or you buy it from us.
That's awesome. Listening to you talk about the hardware is fascinating. I think we could probably dedicate an entire show to just hardware hacking and building. So thanks for that.
Sure.
Let's talk a little more broadly about the overall platform. We talked a little bit about open source. We talked about the hardware. What are some issues that you have right now that you think the community, you'd like to see contributions from the community towards, whether that's hardware, software, business strategy, whatever that may be? What are some of the gaps?
So I'd say the real gap is in software, in the application layer. So the user interface is called Librarian. That's something that it would be great to have, local versions or special use cases. At the end of the day, you can actually see that entire code base on GitHub. And if there's... The thing you should have in your mind is that each one of these hardware instances is really just a web server that accesses content in, you know, a local file system. And so if you can think of some interesting applications and user interfaces for that, you know, whether it's a weather whether it's a mapping application, or it's weather, or, you know, commodity prices, or Bitcoin updating, over throughout the whole world without having an internet connection, you know, that would be outstanding for people to kind of develop applications or develop, you know, different kinds of interfaces. That would be wholly support. And it's one of those things where if you have something, like, we have no problems with just, like, sending it over the air to see, you know, how it works. You know, you can also replicate it, you know, localhost, but we're happy to send it over the air as well.
Syed, one of the concerns expressed both kind of implicitly and explicitly at points is that of censorship. Obviously, with broadcasting, there's not really a whole lot of sort of that control over what people can receive to their various receiving devices. Is this something that concerns you? Is this something that Outernet you think is sort of almost purposefully designed to work around?
Sure. So it was a consideration. When everything was being designed in the early days, it was basically the two constraints, when it, like I mentioned before, when it comes to access information, are economic and then, yeah, to a certain degree, political. And so what kind of a system best addresses both of them at the same time? Naturally, there are all kinds of ways when it comes to internet access. You know, there's Tor and, you know, derivatives of that. But they are all kind of contingent upon access to the internet in the first place. And so if you're really trying to create a globally accessible system that really addresses, you know, the economic barrier, financial barrier, is then you have to actually get away from the internet. That's just not going to work. It's not going to scale to the speed that really want to. Now, granted, you know, the argument against what we're doing is that, oh, well, you still need receivers out in the field. Well, you know, once we start supporting more and more types of devices, when you know, basically, where if you wanted to, it's like we gave you instructions on how to build and manufacture these receivers. Well, then essentially we're seeding an ecosystem that's not that dissimilar from Android, where, you know, we're just the ones who are maintaining the software, and making sure that works, but everyone else is, you know, building their own products and making sure that it gets distributed even the most remote places. And so that goes again to talk about when it comes to anti-censorship is that if we want to be able to get in the most difficult places, whether from just purely logistics or from a political reasons, a political perspective, is that we're not going to be able to address that supply chain. And so it's if we really want to go places where information is limited, then we're going to have to enable people to be able to address those problems locally, because we're not going to be able to solve it.
So talk a little bit about the future. Do you think that there's a situation where if you're disseminating information, right, you're making this information widely available to people, do you envision a sort of a future where maybe governments or powers that be are going to try to prevent this from working? And as a second part to that, what are some defense mechanisms and things you're thinking about to protect against that?
Sure. So that's absolutely something that we're considering. We can't. The reality of just being able to bring something out to the world is that we can't dwell too much on the what ifs. You essentially just have to ship the product and then see how things react. I'm fairly certain that it's not going to happen, you know, right off the bat. But it will happen, especially as more and more, you know, like I said, you know, local shops start building their own receivers in places where, you know, it would be frowned on. And so then what happens is the natural progression, and it has happened in the satellite TV industry, is there are certain jurisdictions who just try to jam satellites. That's very possible to do, especially with a conventional signal. And then what we have to do next is say, okay, well, and we do have basically fail-safes or next steps, if-thens. You know, there are things that we can do to be able to move to different types of infrastructure, satellite infrastructure. There are other types of modulation and coding schemes that we can use. You know, one of the things, really what it comes down to is the best way, the best defense, it unfortunately ends up being that we have to switch to new types of signaling and also require new types of hardware. But ultimately, as long as you give everyone kind of the option and let them know what where things are transitioning, then it's possible. So I was a little vague in all of that. And what I mean by that is that, so for example, if we were to start with, you know, regular TV, you know, KU band broadcasting, and then, you know, that transponder gets jammed, and then, you know, our satellite operator says, okay, well, we need to either turn you off or you have to go to another transponder, say, okay, fine, well, maybe we'll go ahead and move all the educational material to this particular transponder, and then move some of the more controversial content to something that is a little bit more robust in the way that in its RF characteristics. What I mean by that is, like, we can do things like spread spectrum, and so spread spectrum, it, you know, is below the sound floor, and so it is difficult, if not impossible, possible, you know, I say impossible loosely, to jam because it's below the sound, the noise floor. And so what's an example of something that's difficult to jam and it operates the same way? It's like GPS. GPS is actually a heavily spread signal. It exists everywhere, and, you know, it's infrastructure that's always in motion. So that's a great example of what we could move towards if we start seeing difficulties with certain jurisdictions, you know, confronting us when it comes to content delivery. And so there is the path forward there is a path forward that's been designed. We would absolutely love to not have to, you know, go cat and mouse, but, you know, there is a way to be able to solve for those things.
Are there any other projects or decentralized technologies out there that you're looking forward to working with or that would be helpful to sort of your distribution? Obviously, we've talked to guests like Jeff Garzik on the show before, who's working on the BitSat project of distributing, like, multiple cheaply made satellites into space. And it sounds like something very related to sort of this broadcasting issue. But are there any other projects out there that you're particularly interested in or hoping to integrate with OuterNet?
So no, and only because we're really addressing this. We have a very specific use case. Now granted, what Jeff Garz is doing is related. I've been very confused by that approach. I guess I don't fully understand the problem solution over there. Only because I think he'd actually be better off using geostationary satellites and just broadcasting that way. We're in the development of three of our own CubeSats, so it's not like they don't have their place. It's just that when it comes to anything in space, utility is all based on one thing, and that's power. And power in everywhere, especially, specifically when you're dealing with solar, is a function of size. You can't get around that. And with a CubeSat, there's only so much that you can do. And so power is directly related to your communications capacity. And if you're really trying to deliver from a broadcast perspective, be completely accessible to the world, I think the blockchain is something like 1 meg per second now, if I'm not mistaken. You can only do so much with small sats. You're much, much better off if not going to larger, larger satellites, which cost a lot more, or just going to geostationary. So from that perspective, to answer specifically that comment, that's something that, you know, we could actually replicate doing the blockchain right now. It's just a matter of, hey, does anyone want to build something on the receive side? As far as some other platforms we want to build against, it's to our perspective is we really want to see the market and allow people to build applications against. Other infrastructure, we're already, working with, L-band operators, KU-band, C-band. So we're where we want to be from a broadcast infrastructure, and then, of course, building our own assets that go into space. Would it be ideal if we could also work with something like Loon? Yeah, it would be. It would be great. I think that would really solve problems or address it in a different way. But that's just a matter of having the right conversation with the right people and, making sure everyone's in alignment. But once you get away from infrastructure, then it's a matter of, okay, well, let the world take over. We don't want to be standing in anyone's way.
All right, Syed, we're coming to a close here. But before we go, why don't you share where can people find you on social media? What links do you want to share? And do you have any things that you want to plug before people end the show?
Sure. So if you just check OuterNet, if you search for that, you'll come up, with our site, which will be changing in a few weeks. If you want to learn probably the most in-depth place of information, which we've authored, is on the Indiegogo campaign. Probably the best way is just to do IGG space OuterNet in Google search, and that'll come up, Indiegogo OuterNet. And then on Twitter, our handle is OuterNet4All, F-O-R-A-L-L. Facebook, the same, facebook.com/OuterNet4All. And then, if you ever want to reach out to me, I'm at Syed Karim and, pretty accessible over Twitter, email, anything of the sort.
All right, Syed, this is a fascinating project, and we really appreciate you taking time out of your day to join us today and share what you're working on with our listeners. So thanks for joining us.
Thanks for your time.
Absolutely.
Decentralized was edited and produced by Chaz Ferguson. Music written and performed by Tony Lees. You can download past episodes at decentralized.fm or on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/decentralized-podcast. And follow us on Twitter at @decentralizeall.